The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Chapter of Daniel, and you remember that that chapter recorded the dream which the king Nebuchadnezzar had. In that dream there was set forth a great colossus, and that colossus represented the powers of man. It might have been divided into four parts. There were four empires mentioned there. Now, I said a word last night about the identification of those empires. Daniel interpreted that dream when he was yet but a young boy in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Now, the subject with which we are to deal this evening is really the same thing, presented in a different way, given to us in the seventh chapter of Daniel. This chapter also has a date. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Now, we do not know exactly when the first year of Belshazzar was, but I think we may rightly assume that he did not reign for a very long time. The events recorded in this chapter, in other words, occurred shortly before the events that are given to us in the fifth chapter of Daniel, which tells us about the Belshazzar's great feast and his being slain when Babylon had fallen. Belshazzar was a lesser king. He did not equal Nebuchadnezzar in grandeur, and he was not actually a monarch. It so happens that the real king, the real monarch, you might say, was a man by the name of Nabonidus. Yet Nabonidus did not want to exercise the functions of government, with one particular exception, and that was the celebration of the New Year's festival. Nabonidus spent a great deal of his time in Arabia at a place called Tama in the desert, and left the ruling of the kingship unto Belshazzar. In the year 1854, a tablet was discovered which mentions Belshazzar by name and Nabonidus by name, and says that Nabonidus entrusted the kingship to Belshazzar. So Belshazzar was actually the king with whom the Hebrews had to deal. Now, the fifth chapter of Daniel has been the object of a great deal of attack. Some have said that there is an inaccuracy there when it speaks of Belshazzar as king. But I don't see how else you could speak of Belshazzar, unless you went into a long technical explanation every time you mentioned his name, to state what the actual situation was. This tablet says that the kingship was entrusted unto Belshazzar, and I would say that the man unto whom the kingship is entrusted is a king to all practical intents and purposes. Furthermore, we need to notice that the word king is used in a variety of senses in the ancient world. There is a Hittite document which speaks, for example, of the great king, and then it speaks of other kings. The word king need not necessarily mean a monarch. And so, if a man is called king, we have to ask in what sense that is true. Even in the Thousand and One Nights, there is a diversity of uses of the word king. So when Belshazzar is called king, that does not mean that he is sole ruler, but it simply means that he is the man in authority. I personally don't see what else they could have called him but this word king. I have studied this matter and spoken to others about it. I remember that when I was in England, I asked Donald Wiseman what his opinion on the subject was, and he had the same opinion. He said there could be no error in Daniel at this particular point. You will notice that Belshazzar says to Daniel that if he interprets the writing on the wall, he will be made the third in the kingdom, or it may mean one of three in the kingdom. And there again you see an evidence of the accuracy of the book of Daniel, because as a matter of fact, Belshazzar himself was only the second in the kingdom. It was Nabonidus who was the first in the kingdom. Belshazzar, however, to all intents and purposes, was the king. He was the man with whom the Jews had to deal, and they speak of him as Malkah, that is the Aramaic word for king. I cannot see that there is any inaccuracy in that. Now, Belshazzar knew something about Daniel, and he knew something about him because of the interpretation that is given here. Although it may be that Belshazzar himself did not receive this interpretation or did not pay much attention to it. We are simply told that in the first year of Belshazzar's reign, Daniel had these dreams and the vision of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. We have said that one manner in which the revelation of God was given to the prophets was by means of dreams. Dreams are particularly in evidence at this time and also in the life of Joseph. At that time, likewise, the people of God were in a foreign country. Then they were in bondage to Egypt, or at least they were ready to be in bondage to Egypt, and that period is characterized by dreams. Here also, during the exile, God reveals his will by means of dreams. Now, it would be very easy to misunderstand this. It would be very easy to assume that Daniel merely has a dream, and then when he gets up in the morning, he writes down the sum of the matters that he has dreamed and lets it go at that. I do not think we can take it that way. I believe that this is a revelation from God, that God himself has given this material to Daniel in the form of a dream. And that is the reason why Daniel remembers so accurately the content of his dream and why he is able to write the dream down. A dream, after all, is a very elusive thing. I suppose you've all had that experience of waking in the morning or really being about half awake when you're not quite sure whether what you've been dreaming is real or not. And then it sometimes comes to you as quite a relief to find out that what has just a minute before been so vivid is, after all, but a dream. But then when you try to recall the details of your dream, you realize how difficult that is. And if you were to write down a dream that you had had, that would be truly difficult. Daniel can do that because Daniel is inspired of God and is writing down a revelation that God has given to him. Now, he does not write down everything but the sum of the matters, the main points, you might say, of the dream. Daniel spake and said, here he is relating unto us what was the content of his dream. I saw in my vision by night. It was a dream vision that came to him at night, and behold, the four winds of heaven strove upon the great sea. If I understand this verse aright, Daniel means that in his dream he beheld the boundless sea before him, and the four winds of heaven strove, better translated, simply burst forth upon that sea. The winds blew so that the water of the sea was stirred up. The four winds are the winds of the four directions. The sea, as this chapter later points out, stands for man. For the sea is humanity, and from the sea the great nations are to arise. These are human kingdoms. But I think there is something symbolical in what is stated here. The four winds of heaven seem to stand for the powers of heaven. And what we learn is this, that what occurs on earth among men has been decreed by God. The powers of heaven stir up the great sea, and then from that sea the beasts arise. But what takes place on earth does not take place apart from God. God decrees what is to occur here, and that is represented by the winds of heaven, the heavenly winds breaking forth upon the great sea. Then Daniel goes right to the heart of the matter. And I would ask you to notice how succinctly Daniel records these events. I think that is true of the Bible generally. The Bible is not a wordy book. It does not include a lot of unnecessary material. Now, when you and I write, we find it very difficult to be succinct and go right to the point. We have to relate so many matters that are not really essential. The first chapter of Genesis is an example of compact writing. Think of all that it says there. It goes right to the point. Every word is essential. You've heard that story perhaps about the young man who was a reporter. He was beginning his work, and his first assignment was to go out and cover a fire. He did that, and he came back and began to write up about the fire. He wrote page after page telling everything about the fire, and then he handed it in to the editor. And the editor gave it back to him and said, "Cut that down. You've got too much in here." Well, he said, "If I cut that down, I'll leave out something important." And then the editor says to him, "The account of the creation of the world is told in a few hundred words in the first chapter of Genesis, but you need all these pages to tell about a fire." And I think that that hits most of us who write. The Bible goes to the very heart of matters and states only what is essential. So notice as we read here how Daniel brings out just those things that are essential for us to know. In the third verse, there is a general statement. Four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. These beasts, the word simply means animals, these beasts are great. Their size is mentioned, for each one of them represents a human kingdom. They arose from the sea. They partook, as it were, of the nature of the sea. That is, they are human. They come up from mankind. And what is stated about them is that they are diverse one from another. They are not the same. Now, this verse does not tell us whether they came up all at once, simultaneously, or whether they came up one after another. And the answer to that question is left for the subsequent verses. The first was like a lion, and it had eagle's wings. And we are told then that Daniel beheld till the wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given unto it. Now you can see that there is a similarity between this first beast and the head of gold of the great Colossus. Daniel would have recognized right away that this was the Babylonian Empire. This is a lion with eagle's wings. In the book of Ezekiel, Babylon again is represented by the lion and the eagle. That beast and that bird stand for Babylon. There is erected today in the great Kaiser's Museum in Berlin the street leading up to the Ishtar Gate of Babylon. And if you've ever had the privilege of seeing that street, you see on either side a tiled wall. The glaze on the tiles is just as bright today as it was when they were first erected. And on either side there is a procession of lions leading up to the Ishtar Gate. It was the lion that symbolized Babylon and the eagle. And I would suggest that if the book of Daniel was written by some unknown Jew of the second century before Christ, how did he ever come to know that the lion and the eagle symbolized Babylon? This indicates that whoever wrote this was familiar with Babylon, and it points to the fact that Daniel himself was the author. Now, this beast arises, but you will notice that the wings are plucked from it. It is lifted up from the earth and made stand upon its feet like a man. I think that means upon its hind feet, standing upright as a man. And a man's heart is given unto it. There is, in other words, a power that is higher and stronger than the beast, which compels that beast to change its nature. You are perhaps reminded of the time when Nebuchadnezzar was driven from his throne to go out in the fields and to eat and live as did the wild beasts, until he learned that God reigned on high. So this Babylonian Empire is stopped in its conquests, and a human nature, so to speak, is given unto it. It is changed. And we learn right away that there is a power that is greater than Babylon. Now Daniel goes on to say, "And behold, another beast, a second like to a bear. And it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh." This second beast is compared to the bear, which again is known as a rapacious animal. But if you will note, there is a double-sided character to this second beast. If I understand this verse aright, it gives the picture of the feet on one side being raised as though to go forward. The feet on the other side are stationary. And it symbolizes what we might call a double kingdom. I think it is the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. But what is characteristic of this beast is its ability to devour. And the command is given to it to arise and devour much flesh. That means, of course, that it is to conquer many nations. Now let us look briefly at history. Daniel lived in Babylon under the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, the great king. Now, along about the middle of the 6th century before Christ, to the east, in Persia, in the plateau that we today call Persia or Iran, there arose a man in the district known as Anshan, and this man was Cyrus. Cyrus first conquered his own country. Then the Medes joined in with him. And he conquered the district known as Parsua, Persia, and he annexed one territory after another unto himself. The kingdom, however, was of a double kind. It was a Medo-Persian kingdom, the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. And in the 6th chapter, Daniel speaks of the law of the Medes and the Persians. Now Cyrus extended his conquest. And I think it would have been apparent that it was only a matter of time until Cyrus would come down into the Mesopotamian valley and would conquer Babylon also. And that he did in the year 538-539 B.C. Belshazzar was then upon the throne. But Cyrus took the city without fighting, we are told. And in that very night, Belshazzar was slain. Then Darius the Mede took the kingdom, ruling over the Babylonian Empire for a time. Now the law of the Medes and the Persians was in effect at that time. Cyrus did not stop with his conquest of Babylon. As you know, he permitted the Jews to return to Palestine. He allowed his conquered people to worship their own gods. He was a much wiser king in that respect than were the kings of Babylon and Assyria. And so the people were satisfied with his reign. But Cyrus went on extending his kingdom far and wide. And that, I think, is what is meant by this command, "Arise and devour much flesh." This great nation extends itself far more than Babylon had done. Notice, however, that it also is subject to a higher power. The command is given to it. It is not a suggestion, but a command. There is one that is more mighty than Cyrus, more powerful than Medo-Persia. And this one tells the kingdom what it is to do. Arise, devour much flesh. Now that means, of course, that these kingdoms are subject to God. I personally find a great deal of comfort in this fact. It would be very easy for us when we read our newspapers to think that evil was in control of the situation. We might very easily fall into the temptation of believing that the kingdoms of this world actually control things. There was a time when it seemed as though Hitler could have everything that he wanted. It was a tragic thing that this man who was willing to do so much evil could simply go on in his evil ways. When we think of the many that were put to death in those awful concentration camps, it's almost unbelievable. If you have ever visited any of those concentration camps, the very thing makes you just sick to think that men can be so cruel against other men. There is a sign at Dachau today which says, Nie wieder, that is, never again. But we know all too well that it can happen again, that the heart of man is evil. And we may fall into the temptation of thinking that human kingdoms do, after all, control things, that God might like to intervene, that he is impotent to do so. This verse, however, makes it clear that that is not the case. God allows evil to go on only so long, and then he brings it to an end. And where is Hitler now? We no more worry about him, because he and his power are gone. And the power of communism also. Who can say what its future will be? But we know this, that this world is under God's control, and the Russians cannot control this earth as they desire. Communism is not strong enough to destroy the gospel of Christ. And God is in control. When he says, arise, devour much flesh, then the nation will do so, only as long as he permits. But our God is sovereign. He does according to his will, not man's will. In the armies of heaven above and on earth, who can stay his hand and say unto him, what doest thou? Then Daniel looks, and again another animal appears, this time like a leopard or a panther. Upon its back are four wings of a fowl, and it has four heads, and dominion was given to it. This beast symbolized the kingdom that follows Medo-Persia. And what characterizes it is the rapidity with which it can move about. That is shown by the fact that it is represented by a panther or leopard. It is shown also by the fact that it has the four wings. The four heads point, as it were, to the different directions of the earth. For this kingdom has extended itself as Medo-Persia had not been able to do. Now I believe that the reference here is to the Grecian Empire. Alexander the Great extended the sway of that empire far and wide. And we know that he is supposed to have died lamenting that there were no more worlds to conquer. There is a medieval legend to the effect that Alexander even went as far as India. He certainly extended his sway to great distances, at any rate. Now, again, dominion was given to it. Now, I want to stress that fact, that even this kingdom, which had a far greater extent than the two preceding it, had to receive its dominion. Even Alexander the Great was not controlling things. When God wanted his life to go, God took that life. Alexander could not prolong his life. He could not live on forever, nor can any man. Dominion is given to this kingdom. It is given to the kingdom, which means that God is in control of what this kingdom also does. Now the fourth beast is introduced, you will notice, with particular solemnity. Daniel says, after this I saw in the night visions. In order that he may concentrate our attention upon the fourth beast. And then he says, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. Now you will notice that this beast is nondescript. It is not compared to any known animal. Not a lion, nor a bear, nor a panther or leopard. But it is simply said to be dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. The emphasis falls upon the strength of this fourth beast. The first three beasts were known for their ability to conquer. This beast is a beast of strength, a beast which destroys and devours and breaks in pieces. It is set in a part different from the other beasts. It is unique. And Daniel looks at this beast, which is dreadful and fearful and terrible exceedingly. Now, what does this mean? May I just repeat what I said last night? The critical view of Daniel is that the fourth beast is the Grecian Empire. Now, that interpretation is based upon the assumption that the author of Daniel made an historical error. And the error was that he assumed that the second kingdom was Media, and the third kingdom was Persia. I do not believe for an instant that that view can be maintained. Those who hold that the fourth beast was Greece now have to face up to the statement that it had 10 horns, and they must then identify those horns. If the fourth beast is the Grecian Empire, then what is meant by these 10 horns, and what is meant by the little horn? Well, the advocates of this view have no trouble with the little horn. They say that that is Antiochus Epiphanes. You remember we mentioned that man the other night. He was a ruler of Syria. He was also a usurper. And he was a man who committed a great abomination in Jerusalem, entering the temple on the Sabbath day and erecting an idol there in the temple. He is a forerunner in the 11th chapter of Daniel of the Antichrist himself. Now the higher critics tell us that this Antiochus Epiphanes is the little horn. The reason, or one reason why they say that, is in the 8th chapter there is also mention of a small horn, a little horn, which very obviously is Antiochus Epiphanes. The two, therefore, we are told, are said to be the same thing. Now, without going into it in any great detail, I've written a number of pages on it in my commentary on Daniel. I think it can be shown very clearly that the little horn of chapter 7 and the little horn of chapter 8 are not the same and are not intended to show the same thing. If you hold that the little horn here is Antiochus Epiphanes, then you must hold, of course, that the fourth kingdom is the Grecian Empire. And then you are faced with the problem of identifying the 10 horns. Just what are those 10 horns? Now those who seek to identify the 10 horns try to find 10 rulers among the Seleucids, that is 10 rulers of Syria, and that this culminates in Antiochus Epiphanes. And then you have the additional problem of identifying the 3 horns that were uprooted by Antiochus Epiphanes, the so-called little horn. Now a great deal of scholarly work has been expended in an endeavor to do that, and I just want to say it can't be done. There were not these 10 rulers that fit the picture here. I think when we begin to identify these 10 horns, we get ourselves into very great difficulty, especially if we are limited to 10 rulers of Syria. It does not fit the picture at all. And I am more and more convinced that those who would make of the fourth kingdom the Grecian Empire have really missed the point of the book of Daniel. That is a great error. We shall see that with respect to the 70 weeks, when we make these fit into the period of Antiochus Epiphanes, we really take the meaning out of that prophecy. But that is the widespread view of the book of Daniel today. It is almost a dogma of modern criticism. If you pick up modern books on the Bible, you will find that this is stated with almost no evidence being given to support it. The critics have reached a point now where they simply make assertions with little supporting evidence. And this is one of the fundamental dogmas of modern higher criticism, that the fourth beast in Daniel is Greece. And you can judge a commentary by its identification of the fourth kingdom. If it says that the fourth kingdom is the Grecian Empire, you can be pretty sure you're dealing with a commentary written from the liberal standpoint. Now I would ask also, what was there about the Grecian Empire that made it fundamentally different from the 3 that preceded it? I cannot see that that difference is present. Then also, I think we need to point out that there never was this separate Median Empire and Persian Empire, and this identification is based upon the assumption that the writer of Daniel made an error. Now, I'm not willing to grant that. I don't think there's any evidence to support that. There is an error made, but it wasn't made by the writer of the book of Daniel. It's made in this incorrect identification of the fourth kingdom. Well, what then is this fourth kingdom? In line with what we said last night, that during the days of these kings, the God of heaven would erect a kingdom, I think we are compelled to say that the fourth kingdom is the historical Roman Empire, the empire that was on the scene when our Lord was born. The Roman Empire differed from those that preceded it. Now, John in the Revelation goes back to this, and John perceives that the great enemy of the people of God is first Babylon, and he speaks of Babylon as the mother of harlots and abominations, for he is taking that from Daniel and from Isaiah. And then John rightly goes on to see that the great enemy of the people of God is Rome. This is the enemy of God's people. Incidentally, the book of Revelation is based very largely upon the language of Isaiah and Daniel. It is almost unbelievable how much of Isaiah and Daniel are found in the book of Revelation. And the divine interpretation of these two books, of course, is given to us in the book of Revelation. All right, then, this kingdom is diverse. Literally, it is acting diversely from those that were before it. It is set apart. It is distinct. This is the Roman Empire. This is the culmination of the kingdom of man. This is the ecumenical world empire at its strongest. It is Rome. For it is while Rome was in existence that our Lord was crucified. But now Daniel calls attention to the ten horns. And it had ten horns. Just what does that mean? Now, I don't want to be dogmatic, because there are so many differences of opinion here. We have a book in our library at Westminster Seminary written by a French scholar who had it in, apparently, for 10 bishops in the French church. And he identified those 10 bishops as the 10 horns. I don't know that his view is particularly widespread. At any rate, I think that kind of thing is very dangerous. There were people not so long ago, you know, who were pretty sure that Mussolini was the little horn. And they were making identifications of that kind. They were saying that he was the Antichrist or the man of sin. Now, if we look at this, it seems that on the head of this beast there were 10 horns. They symbolize a particular period in the development or growth, you might say, of the beast. I do not think that if we try to identify them, we will get anywhere by identifying 10 kings or kingdoms or 10 people that are precise contemporaries. That's what we would actually have to do, because these horns are right there at one time on the head of the beast. I hold this view, and I set it forth rather tentatively. It seems to me that these 10 horns signify a period that will follow the historical Roman Empire. Then there comes the little horn. And the little horn is characterized by the fact that it has eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that speaks great things. By saying that it speaks great things, the Bible means that it speaks blasphemous, presumptuous things. Now, that little horn, from the remainder of the book of Daniel, of this chapter at least, appears to be the power that is opposed to God, what we may call the Antichrist. And if I understand this rightly, we have a picture of the Roman Empire, and then of a period subsequent to the Roman Empire, and then of a time when the opposition to Christ will concentrate itself. And that concentrated opposition is represented by the little horn. Now, that little horn may stand for a kingdom. It may stand for an individual, the man of sin. It may stand for an ideology such as communism. It may stand even for a coalition of governments. I do not know. And I do not think the Bible is specific enough here so that we can go around pointing to different people and different kingdoms and saying, that is the little horn. On the other hand, I think the Bible is specific enough so that we can recognize the work of the little horn wherever we find it. Wherever there is opposition and hostility to the work of Christ, there is the work of the little horn. Now, according to this chapter, that work will be intensified as the days draw to a close. The power of evil will be strengthened, and it will all but destroy the people of God. It will progress for a time, for times, and then we would expect it to say for four times, giving a complete number of seven, but instead of that it says, and the dividing of a time, implying that the power of the little horn will be cut off. In other words, I think there is given us here a picture of the kingdom of man from the time of Babylon until the second coming of Christ. The period that is characterized by the ten horns seems to me the very period in which we are living. There are empires and kingdoms which in one sense or another may trace their origin back to Rome. They are the kingdom of man. They exist for a time, and then the power of evil in this concentrated form appears upon the scene. The little horn is boastful and blasphemous against the work of God until finally he is destroyed. Now as Daniel hears this little horn uttering these blasphemous words, his eyes are lifted to heaven, and there he sees a judgment scene. There is a throne of fire with wheels of fire, and a fiery stream issues from before it. And on that throne there sits the Ancient of Days. That simply means an aged, venerable person. The symbol is of God seated upon the throne of judgment. It is certainly one of the most majestically conceived scenes in all of the Old Testament. There is God seated upon the throne of judgment. And all this while we hear the words of the little horn. Then the thrones are cast down. That does not mean they are destroyed, but it means they are thrown down in order that judges may sit upon them. And then there is brought unto the Ancient of Days with the clouds of heaven one like the Son of Man. The words Son of Man simply mean a man, but there comes on the clouds of heaven this one like the Son of Man. That symbolism signifies the deity, for the coming on the clouds of heaven is a coming to judge, and it is only God who can judge. And like the prophecy of Isaiah that we considered this afternoon, so here also there is a foreshadowing of the doctrine of the Trinity. God is upon the throne, yet there comes with the clouds of heaven one that is himself divine, that performs the functions that only God can perform. The judgment is uttered, and the fourth beast is given to the burning of fire, a complete destruction of the kingdom of man. But to the Son of Man there is given a kingdom that is said to be an eternal kingdom and a universal kingdom. Now, if you will look at these kingdoms of the beasts, you will see that there is a great deal that is similar about them. All of them arose from the sea. That is, they are all a human kingdom. And we need to realize that that which is human is temporal. I remember in Germany that when Germany for a time had an alliance with Russia, Hitler had placards all over the city, at least all over Leipzig where I was, saying that that Russia was the Third Reich's eternal friend. Now that's fairly strong language. And I remember that in the Pantheon one evening there was a German lady who made this statement or asked this question. Do you think, she said, that anything human can really be eternal? There were some people that weren't taken in by all of that. Well, nothing that is merely human can be eternal. And every one of these kingdoms was human in origin. It arose from the sea. Notice this also. Every one of these kingdoms sought to be universal, worldwide. Each succeeding kingdom was more universal than the one preceding it. But that isn't really an accurate way of speaking. A thing either is universal or it is not universal. What I should say is that each succeeding kingdom sought to conquer more territory than the one preceding it. And we know how much territory Rome has conquered. But none of these kingdoms is truly universal. Where is Babylon today, or the remains of her rule? She never conquered the whole world, nor did Medo-Persia, nor Greece, nor even Rome. Furthermore, each one of these kingdoms sought to be eternal. The Babylonian kings spoke of themselves in language that implied that they were always on the throne. Each one sought to be eternal. for they wanted to rule God out of the picture. And so it is with the stage represented by the 10 horns. We fall into the error of thinking that human kingdoms will endure forever. But where is Babylon today? And where is Medo-Persia? You may visit Athens and see some of the glory that was Greece. You may go to the Forum at Rome and see the ruins of ancient Rome. But those kingdoms are gone, never to appear again upon the scene of history. They are human. They are local. And they are temporal kingdoms. But now the kingdom of the Son of Man is quite different. It is of divine origin. And that is why it is universal. And that is why it is eternal. I do not believe that we find in this passage any warrant for belief in a revived Roman Empire. I think that this is a picture of things until Christ comes. And looking at it that way, we can see that it has a great deal of encouragement to offer unto us. The kingdom of the Son of Man is a universal kingdom. That is all over the world today. Even behind the iron curtain, the bamboo curtain, there are men and women that acknowledge Jesus Christ as the King. They are not excluded from this kingdom because of their race, or because of their color, or because of their nationality. For this is a universal kingdom. I remember that when I sailed to Palestine the first time, I was on a ship that stopped, it seemed to me, at almost every port, and I was glad for that because I was seeing more of the world. And we finally went up into the Black Sea. We went through the Dardanelles and into the Black Sea. And as we sailed through the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus and so on, we were very close to land. And I was standing there on the deck of the ship looking at that land, for that was Asia. And I was just a boy at the time and quite thrilled to see that new country. There was a lady on that ship who was going to Palestine as a missionary to the Jews. And she took me to task for showing any enthusiasm about this country. That, she said, is Turkey. And don't you know that the book of Ezekiel teaches that no Turk and no Russian can possibly be saved? Well, I've heard the book of Ezekiel accused of teaching a lot of strange things before, but never anything quite like that. And we may thank God that that is not the case. Men are not excluded from the kingdom because of their nationality. The kingdom of the Son of Man is truly a universal kingdom. And we may rejoice in that fact. We are not alone. All over this world, there are men and women who acknowledge the same Jesus Christ as their King. And furthermore, this is an eternal kingdom. And we who probably are living at the time of these 10 horns, or it may be that the little horn is with us, whatever be the case, we are members of a kingdom that will not perish. All of the force of communism cannot destroy Christianity, and all of the indifference of professing Christians cannot destroy Christianity. For our King is the Son of Man, who will come with the clouds of heaven in glory, and His kingdom is an eternal kingdom and will not pass away. In the city of Damascus in Syria, there is a great mosque which the Mohammedans accept as one of their most sacred buildings. Along one of the walls of this mosque today, there are a number of small shops. And if you were to go there, you could ask one of the storekeepers or shopkeepers for a stepladder. And he would know what you wanted it for, and he would give you that stepladder. And then you could climb up on the roof of the shop and walk right over and touch the wall of the mosque. If you were to do that, you would find a number of small bushes growing there, and you would pull back these bushes until you found the thing for which you were looking. There is an old doorway that is all walled up, and the whole thing has been whitewashed over. But on the lintel of that doorway, there are these words in the Greek language: Thy kingdom, O Christ, is an everlasting kingdom, and thy reign endureth forever and ever. You see, at one time, this building was a Christian church, and the true God was worshipped therein. The forces of infidelity have all but obliterated the fact that at one time the true God was worshipped in this building. But Satan is never completely thorough. And these words remain to bear their mute yet eloquent testimony to the fact that the true God was once worshipped in this building. And so it is. It may seem that the kingdom of the Son of Man has come upon dark days and that it will perish from off the face of the earth. But it is not for us to be discouraged. We are to look at the King and to remember that we are members of an eternal kingdom. In the kingdoms of this world, there is darkness and there is unrest. But in the kingdom of the Son of Man, there is peace. And there is life, and there is light, and there is hope. Enter ye in.